Hi and welcome everyone. I'm Stacey Barr, the Performance Measure Specialist of www.stacybarr.com and creator of the Performance Measure Blueprint Workshop at www.performancemeasureblueprint.com. Welcome to my February 2008 teleseminar on 10 key lessons for implementing KPIs. And this is a special interview with KPI expert David Parmenter. Now, I'm going to introduce David properly in just a few moments. But for those of you who are new to my Measurement Handy Hints e-zine or have joined this call through a friend or a colleague, welcome. And to those of you who are regulars on these monthly teleseminars, welcome back. As usual, the total call will go for about an hour. And over this time, I'm going to be talking with David about what he's learned are the keys to implementing a balanced scorecard in 16 weeks rather than 16 months. Even if you're not using the balanced scorecard as your KPI framework, and whether it's a large organization you work in or a small business, at least a few of David's lessons are going to be great reminders or little pearls of insight that are going to really help you improve how to develop and roll out your organization's KPIs. Now, I am really pleased to introduce my guest today, David Parmenter, CEO and Managing Director of Waymark Solutions based in New Zealand. David has over 10 years of specializing in assisting organizations to measure, report, and improve their performance. He's an international presenter and authority on a wide range of topics that relate to organizational performance, like quarterly rolling planning, for example. He's a regular writer for professional and business journals and has a series of webinars on bettermanagement.com also. Now, I think David may actually mention a little bit more about those webinars later on. They're wonderful resources to get some quick learning. David's also the author of a really great book, and I've read it, and it's, in fact, the thing that's led us to this teleseminar. Now, the book is called Key Performance Indicators, Developing, Implementing, and Using Winning KPIs, and what I really love about this book is that it provides a framework for how to manage KPI projects and manage them well. It's the big picture that pulls together all of the details, the steps of getting performance measures implemented. David, I am really pleased to have you join us today.
And thank you so much for this opportunity. And I certainly commend Stacey all the work that you're doing in this area as well. We're both very passionate about it. And I'd like to say greetings to all those listening now and those who will listen sometime in the future.
Thanks, David. I love that word, passionate. I don't know that too many people would ever think of passionate about performance measurement as things that belong in the same sentence, but I know you and I definitely feel that. David, as I mentioned before, I really loved your book, Key Performance Indicators, and I guess from my perspective, much of the framework for implementing KPIs that it details is based around these 10 key lessons that you talk about in one of the early chapters in the book. Now, that's pretty much the structure of our call today, so maybe just by way of an overview, can you quickly tell us where these 10 lessons came from and maybe introduce each one of them in turn? We'll obviously delve into each one of them in more depth.
Yeah. We all have a horror story about performance management, and I thought your particular one, Stacey, on your website or one of your, was very a good one as well. But in my one, I was asked by a ministry to come in to help them with their balanced scorecard. So I thought this sounded good. And this was in the early days of my involvement really in performance management. I went in there and found the senior management team who had met on and off for about five major meetings over 14 months and had 2 months left to finish off the balanced scorecard. But in these 14 months, the only thing that they had done was actually determine the names of the four perspectives. Well, actually, this can be done in about five, that can be done in 5 minutes. But they thought, you know, that they put a lot of intellectual thoughts, and there were some very bright people in the senior management team, but that's as far as they'd got, and their outputs had been this beautiful origami thing that had gone around to all staff. So they began to panic because 30th of June was coming up and they hadn't got anything, any measures at all. And so they brought me in and said, David, could you just finish off the work? We've near enough done it, but just do the measures. And I said, well, this is not exactly how you run one of these projects. At that point, I really wasn't too familiar with the 12-step process, which is in the book, but I knew that this was not the way forward. And I asked to see certain people, and they said, why do you need to do that? Just have a look at all our notes. Our meeting notes should be enough. Well, suffice to say, I should have simply said to them, I'd rather go golfing than be involved in this project, which of course I do now. But back then, I was a bit short of money at the time. I thought, well, if that's what they want, I will do my best. Well, I was sort of locked in a room, just in a dark room, just like Mushroom, and fed a lot of crap. And suffice to say, the measures that I came up with wouldn't fit the organisation and had a hope. And of course, they weren't happy with them either. So we parted company. And as a bit of therapy, I wrote an article called A Balanced Scorecard in 16 Weeks, Not 16 Months. And I try to work out from the lesson of this experience, you know, where had it really gone wrong? And I developed these lessons, and they have migrated, actually. If anybody sort of tracks down the original article, you'll see that the lessons are slightly different, only a few of them, and they're in different order. But that's how it came about. So the lessons that are in the book are, we want to find an external project facilitator. We need to begin with senior management commitment and carry that on throughout the whole project. A focus on the critical success factors. A rule I developed called the 10-80-10 rule. Why we need a small KPI team. Why it has to be a just do it team. You know, the Nike just do it. Now, interesting enough, another vital part of these lessons came from the work that Captain Norton did in their earlier book, The Translating Strategy into Action, The Balanced Scorecard, which I believe is their best book. Using existing systems for the first 12 months, and we'll talk about that later, why we've got to track the measures, you know, while we're brainstorming. The KPI formats are an art form, not a science. And maybe, the last one, maybe you need to rename. And that is, sometimes just by calling it a balanced scorecard is a kiss of death. If you've got a senior management team who've had a negative experience, why don't we call it something else? We'll talk about that. So they're the 10 lessons that I wish to talk about today.
David, the thought that was coming to my mind as you shared that story with me, because that's actually the first time I've heard it. I mean, geez, talk about initiation by fire into the performance measurement world. But it's that idea of that group that you first worked with were very much thinking of performance measurement as an afterthought, that you could just whip up some performance measures at the drop of a hat or just get someone in to tell you what they should be. And it seems like where you've really sort of, you've taken that and turned it into where you are today. It's about very much forethought, putting the right amount of thinking up front into a performance measurement initiative, and acknowledging that it's not just a bolt-on thing that you do. You actually need to plan how to integrate it into your organisation. Is that a fair perception?
Yeah, very much so. And really, we've got to acknowledge Kaplan Norton here. Their balanced scorecard work in 1992 was, I believe, the management breakthrough in the 90s, and they were the people that emphasised the importance of senior management commitment, and in fact they were the people who talked about the 16 weeks concept of you've got to get some runs on the board quickly in order to make sure the senior management team is still with you, because of course they'll lose interest if the project goes on forever.
No, there's no doubt in my mind the impact that they've had in just making performance measurement, and in particular the non-financial performance measurement, up there in its importance, along with strategy design and you know, other senior executive type activities. They really, that was the breakthrough, I think, for getting all of us where we are today. David, how about we start looking at each of your 10 lessons in turn, and I think the first one you mentioned was about focusing on the CSFs, is that right? No, finding a...
No. Lesson one is
finding
external
an external project
facilitator.
That's the one. Yes. I'd scrolled down too far on my outline.
Yes, no
problem. How about we delve... we delve down into that one, why is it important for the facilitator to be external? And, you know, no doubt that that might be good for external consultants, but in what way is having an external facilitator better for the organisation?
Well, the very first step is that to make sure we get the project set up in the right way. We need an external facilitator who's going to educate and be listened to by the SMT so they can see that their concept of performance measurement does need a shift and that this project is something very different. And in fact, it may even, through the education process, mean that senior management team recognise that the project should be deferred to a better window, because you really do need to find a time when senior management can contribute for a 16-week period. Not 16 every week within those 16, but we can't have, for example, a takeover, a merger happening, or a major external factor that would divert management, senior team, away from this exercise. So we've got to find this window to do it. So the external facilitator also is so important, because we don't want this project to be run by consultants, external consultants. We want the external consultants to train an in-house team who then are capable of doing it themselves with support which tails off during the length of the project. Initially, the team will need a lot of team building to be done, some training to fill out some of the holes that the team members have. But we would have, we will have selected the team very carefully, and that again is where the facilitator comes in, because I think an external facilitator who's experienced in performance management would help put together a better team than the internal senior management team would do.
I hadn't realised that it really is a lot of importance in the choice of those words then, David, the project facilitator, not the consultant, not any other word. Facilitator is a very deliberate word that you've chosen there.
Very deliberate, very deliberate. And we are talking about somebody who cannot be on the project team. They are not part of the team. They are not the project manager. This is to get this job done well, it has to be in-house. So many failed balance scorecards happen because the senior management team bring in the external consultants and say, look, we're all too busy, could you do it for us? And to be fair on many external consultants, they say, no, this isn't how you should do it. And the senior management team turn around and say, well, we're paying the money, you do what you're told.
Mm-hmm. It's just amazing how many people even today still think that other people are going to have the answers for them with regards to setting up their performance measurement system. But the idea of, like you say, David, building that internal capability, that is just such an essential part of the buy-in process, that whatever measures get developed, whatever system gets put in place, actually gets used and valued by the organisation, and they don't have an easy out and say, oh, well, the consultant obviously came up with bad measures, so let's just dump the whole thing. And I have seen that happen. So that's your first lesson is about the external project facilitator. Is there anything else you want to add, David, before we go on to your second lesson?
Yes, I mean, let's talk about what they should be. These third party, the project facilitator should be free of any proprietary applications. We don't want them pushing their own application down the throats. And we'll talk about applications a bit later. Should be well versed in performance measures and have very well rounded consultancy skills. Now, interesting here, my vision of these facilitators is they will never present to management other than that initial step of selling the project and maybe getting the senior management team on board. After that point, the project team always present themselves with the facilitator very much the backroom person. They've obviously got to have credentials that the SMT will listen and follow advice, and if a project was going off track, they would come in immediately and have a one-to-one with the CEO to straighten things up. And they should be able to motivate. Now, motivation is so important on this project, because one thing I've learned as the grey hairs are multiplying with me is that most projects fail because we don't sell the project via the emotional driver, the plural emotional drivers, of the main buyers in the organisation. We've got to find what turns them on and sell it that way. Far too often, projects are sold by logic, which is not the way. You never buy a car from a car yard by logic. It's all done by the emotional drivers, and the salesmen know this. The same car in a car yard can be sold to a young IT person by how fast it can go and its brake horsepower and great cornering. And this, and another person comes up, like myself with grey hair, they'll talk about how many airbags it's got. And something else may turn up, and they'll talk about the decor and the beautiful walnut veneer and so forth. They're clever. They know how to sell. Often in business, we don't sell through those emotional drivers. And this is where the facilitator is so important. In the early days, they will sell both to the senior management and, in many cases, to the board, because the board need to realize that there's going to be a change here.
There are some really important characteristics. That's a very practical list, David, of the sort of characteristics and capabilities that a facilitator needs to have. And it really clarifies their role, too, as very much in a supportive, holding the space or holding the space for the people in the organisation to learn, to encounter problems in a safe way and to really develop that buy-in.
Mm.
So, David, what about your second lesson, beginning with the senior management team's commitment and education? So I know that there'll probably be a few of our listeners out there sitting on the edge of their chairs waiting to hear what you've got to say about this, because it's something that I often get asked, and many people know, is what makes or breaks a performance measurement initiative, and that is, you know, having no support from the top, because, you know, performance measurement just won't become the priority it needs to be and get the resources it needs. So, David, what's the lesson here?
Well, most big projects fail because of this, and I believe that until you've succeeded in this step, in this lesson, it is actually step one in the 12-step process as well, that you need to just stop and don't go on. If the senior management or the team, and particularly the CEO, says, oh, look, this is great, but I want to assign it to a project team which can come and give me feedback every now and again, you should just simply say, look, we're not going ahead with this project. No, it's not the right time. It's something where you've really got to say, unless the CEO is going to live and breathe this, this isn't going to work. But the penny hasn't dropped. And for some people who are very passionate about it, you've either got to wait for the change in CEO or possibly go to another organization with an enlightened CEO. But please don't start this project if the senior management aren't turned on by it. And there's a lot of stuff to help them. I've talked about it a lot. I've given a lot of web seminars now on www.bettermanagement.com, where I talk about the British Airways story. And generally, if a CEO has listened to it, they can see where we're going, and it might sort of, it might be that bright light that wakes them up or shows them the pathway. But again, this is where the facilitator comes in. Now, the first thing that would happen with the SMT is that the facilitator would do a half-day workshop with the SMT to explain why performance management isn't really functioning well in the organization and to describe what the vision could be and also to go through the different types of performance measures and what is defined by a key performance indicator, maybe talk about the British Airways story or other performance measurement stories. And so that at the end of the half day, senior management could go, yes, we want to go ahead with this, or no, we don't. If they say no, that half day will not be a wasted half day, because senior management will have at least eyes open and will be starting to realize why the monthly reporting system isn't, you know, producing anything, why it's just simply memorandums of information rather than decision-based reporting.
Planting the seeds,
so
in a sense, of getting them to reflect on different things from that point forward. So they may not be ready straight away, but it's planting the seeds for getting them to think about, well, hang on, next time I look, you know, next time they look at a performance report, they'll be looking at it through slightly different eyes because they'll have had that half-day workshop that's sort of given them new ideas for thinking about those sorts of things.
Yes, indeed. And in some cases, we can actually, at this stage, carry on with a two-day critical success factor workshop where the senior management team are involved. But I think maybe we should talk about that in the next stage, in lesson three. But let's just, I want to give you a quote from Captain Norton, and this is from the original book, and here it goes. The scorecard development process should not be delegated to a middle management task force. For the balanced scorecard to be effective, it must reflect the strategic vision of the SMT. If the SMT are not leading the process, they will continue to conduct operational reviews that emphasize meeting short-term financial targets, thereby bypassing and undermining the fundamental rationale for developing a balanced scorecard in the first place. And that was back in 1992, and those words, I believe, are true now and will be true in 300 or 400 years' time.
It's a cold, hard truth, that one. And I know I'm very confident there'll be people listening thinking, oh, my God, I'm not going to have senior management involvement. Is there nothing I can do? Well, aside from what you've suggested about starting to plant the seeds with the senior management team, there is one strategy that I know a few organizations are doing, and that's, you know, while they're not thinking about developing the measurement system for the entire organization all at once, they're picking one little pocket that's really committed to it, that is desperate to get better control over their process or their functional area, and they work with that team and help them really do a mini version of the of a performance measurement system. But it is more like a pilot or a testing bed or an experiment that then can become a case study and something for the broader organization to sort of watch in on and see what's happening. And the more successful it is, the more attention that it gets. And that can actually be another way to plant seeds and get senior management involved as well.
I think that's certainly an approach, and it's with every organisation, the actual project is a fingerprint that's going to for that organisation. I never suggest that the 12 steps will happen in a precise order, but as long as they're all covered. The one thing I would say about when you do a pilot is please, though, do that half-day workshop with the SMT, so that they will at least show interest in that project.
Good idea.
You know, so you can have a great pilot going, but you know, if the SMT is still not, you know, if the eyes aren't open, you know, we can lose all that valuable experience, and it will be shoveled under the carpet again.
Very, very wise words. So, David, I'm doing the teleseminar host thing and keeping a track of time, and I know that we still have another 8 lessons to get through. So, and I know you were just about ready to start talking about the third one, which is about focusing on the CSFs, or the critical success factors, I assume is what that means. I guess it's not going to come as a surprise to anybody, because most of us know that, you know, you only measure what really matters. But you mean a little bit more than just that with this one, don't you, David?
Indeed. I believe that most organisations know their success factors, but they don't know what are their critical success factors. So the word critical is very important. I believe we're talking the top 5 to 8 success factors. What are they, and how do we sort out what the from all the success factors, which could be 30 to 40, and sift through them and come up with this 5 to 8. I believe, and the good news here, is that it can be done in a very short time frame. A two-day workshop, in fact, is where the bulk of it is done. Prior to the two-day workshop, the project team will go through all the strategic documentation over the last 10 years and scan it for all those success factors that have littered all over the place. They'll be interviewing the senior management team and some board members, and they'll just you'll get a lot from those interviews. So you'll have may be 40 critical success factors, and some will be different versions of the same. So you'll sift those through. And in the workshop, we then start a process of fine-tuning them to find out where do the top 5 to 8 come from. And I sort of slightly differ from Kaplan-Norton here. Kaplan-Norton went on in their recent books with their strategic mapping exercise by slotting critical success factors into a perspective. And if you see the diagrams, they all have the perspectives going up on the left-hand side of the page, till the top one being financial. I don't like that, because a critical success factor, a good one, one of the top 5 to 8, can't fit in a perspective. It's much broader than that.
And I really like this idea.
I've developed this technique where we get the various teams, and we break them up into work groups, and we brainstorm the linkages between the 40 or so critical success factors. During the first part of the workshop, we actually fine-tune to find out what really are those 40, because we've got to get the wording right. I mean, let's talk about a critical success factor called increased repeat business. And you'll see that in many organizations. Yep, we want repeat business from existing customers. But you say, well, hold it. Do you want repeat business from all customers? And quite quickly, management, when asked that question, say, no. We want it from our profitable customers. Well, that's correct. So why don't we say that? And another classic one is delivery in full on time as a critical success factor. We want to deliver in full on time to our customers. And you say, well, hold it here. Do you want dispatch to treat every customer as equal? So if they've got 100 dispatches in the day, do they do the 99 easy ones and leave the one hard one to your major customer and sacrifice that? Or would you rather they got that one right first and then did the other 99 minor ones? Of course, that's what you want. So we then have to change the wording to delivery in full, on time, to all key customers. Because that now communicates to people in the workplace where you're meant to be looking, and, of course, on the measures. Far too many companies measure all deliveries on them.
This emphasis that you have on critical success factors is getting beyond the motherhood statements that you see in so many strategic plans. Just, you know, you could almost put all of these strategic plans together, mix them up, and send them back to different organizations, and they'd almost fit because they're just so generic in what they're saying. So you're saying, let's unpack it, let's make it a lot more specific, and let's really say what we mean and make it right and unique for our organization.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people when they first start this exercise, they're almost like strategic objectives. I mean, you know, when you've got a strategic objective, it means that very few people fully understand it, and it's very bland, and it doesn't communicate anything to anybody. You know, we want to increase profitability, right? Yeah, that's very useful. There's no how in it. A true critical success factor tells an individual at the workplace what they've got to do to improve performance, and it's very specific. And the words are very clear, and, you know, a reading age between 12 and 14, because you've got to remember, people at the workplace some people haven't had that education we have. And the words have got to be very carefully chosen, so they are communicating. And we are thinking of the behavior that they're going to generate. In this two-day process, outcomes this very valuable hierarchy. I'm going to deliver next month on bettermanagement.com a 45-minute section on that. So I suggest we move on. People, if they're interested, can sort of touch base in a bit more depth on that process, and also read it from the book.
I'll put a link on the page for anybody who's interested in David's, David, in your bettermanagement.com seminars. I'll put a link on the playback page and email it out to people of how they can get to those and listen to them. But your fourth key lesson, David, geez, the 10-80-10 rule, yeah, that's really going to need some explaining.
Yeah.
What's it all about?
Yeah, well, the good news there is that it all started again, really, from Captain Lawson. They were the first people to start saying that, you know, you don't have 200 KPIs in an organization. If you do, you have chaos. They were suggesting, you know, no more than 20. But one of the flaws, I'd have to say, they never defined what a KPI was. So that's what led to a lot of people just naming every single measure a key performance measure.
It's almost interchangeable with the word performance measure. It's just, it's become a generic term.
Yeah, that's right. And then Hope and Fraser, I met Jeremy Hope of Beyond Budgeting fame, and he talked about, you know, less than eight. And, of course, for those people who are familiar with the British Airways story, British Airways turned themselves around by focusing on one KPI. So I needed to sort of explain to people that less was better than more. So I developed this rule called the 10-80-10. What it's trying to say is that we need about 10 or no more than 10 KPIs in an organization, and less is better than more. So if you find you've only got two or three, well, that's great. You need to remember, though, that to be a KPI, there are a couple of characteristics, one of which is that it's not, they're non-financial. The minute you put a dollar sign, a yen sign, a pound sign in front of a performance measure, you've actually converted it into what I call a result indicator. And if you listen to my web seminar or read the book, I explain the difference. The 80 means that there are lots of measures in an organization which aren't KPIs. I call them result indicators, such as things that you're anything with the, you know, any financial ones. Also, for example, like in a hospital, you might have bed utilization. That's a result indicator. The key word result meaning it's a summation of a lot of people's activity. I mean, hospitals around the world think bed utilization is a KPI, yet who do you ask to increase it? Who's directly responsible? When you look at it, bed utilization is reflects the patient, reflects the patient's family who may or may not want them out of hospital, reflects the orderlies who, did they get the patient on time into theatre, affects how the theatre's operating and all the professionals there, and reflects on, you know, when the bed was made up, and also, of course, even the doctor who referred it to the consultant. All these
people. That's a very cross-functional result.
Exactly. So I call that a result indicator. Nice to have, but you'll never get change from them. You'll look at them, and you can observe change happening, but you'll never create the thing that you want. You need to peel the onion off to find what I call the KPIs, which are right at the work face, which are linked to your critical success factors. And when they start moving in the right direction, the organization starts to perform in the next level. And at the top of the
with 10-80-10, is that
so? The 10, I'm saying 10 KPIs, 80 or so result indicators and performance indicators, and the other 10 are what I call key result indicators. These are real summary result indicators, such as return on capital employed, customer satisfaction. You know, the big ones that the board loves to hear about, but have never been KPIs. And these just tell us how we're going. And if we're going well, the board are happy. If we're not going well, the board will be concerned. But they're great overall measures. They're useless to management, really, because they don't tell you anything about the organization, how it's currently operating. It just gives it's a past figure, and it's a very global figure. And it's useful for those people in governance, such as board. And I've set out what I consider a board dashboard would look like. So that's where the 10-80-10 rule came from.
Great. So it's really about thinking about types of performance measures, very much in line with what their purpose is and who should be using them to affect change in the organization.
That's correct. So in summary, there isn't one performance measure called a KPI. In fact, I believe there are four different types, and I have broken that out, and there's a paper on bettermanagement.com which explains it all.
Lovely. That's fantastic. So we're up to lesson five, David, and I think that one is about selecting a small KPI team. I've seen so many decentralized approaches to performance measurement that, well, it's like they end up creating a great big gluggy mess of measures that don't align to anybody or to any aspect of the strategic direction. And usually it's associated with lots of wasted effort and different approaches. No one's really got the time to do any of it properly. It does need to be centralized and coordinated. And my guess is this part of what you mean by lesson five, David, having a small KPI team for the organization?
Well, that's part of it. But part is that this team has to be a full-time team. This is not a project where you're going to be doing, if I've got somebody from HR or somebody from operations or somebody from the finance team and so forth, they are able to hold down their current position and be involved in this project. This KPI team are like some of the big IT projects where you second staff. These are totally dedicated and literally banned from going back to their offices. In fact, I would recommend that these people, that the people who are stepping up into their shoes physically move into that person's office. So in other words, the photographs get taken down, the pictures of the partner and the dog or cat get taken off the desk, so that they literally can't go back to their desk for that duration of time. They've moved out. So these people then, I mean, how many can you afford to have? And how many, if the team gets too big, it gets unwieldy, as we all know about IT projects. So I believe on a reasonable size organization, you can work quite comfortably with four. These four people then at critical stages in the project, they split up and they go out holding the workshops where the teams around the organization will be brainstorming, and you might be having two or three of these concurrent in different parts of the country on the same day. These KPI team people will be ringing each other at night talking about what they found. And sometimes there'll be two working together, but certainly you do need a critical mass here so you can get the rollout happening in different places simultaneously in order to achieve.
And this is what so many organizations fail to do is properly resource their performance measurement attempts and initiatives. They think everybody can do it on top of their current jobs. But David, what you're saying is, no, you need to pick people that are in some way passionate about doing this. They're going to work together and give all of their time and attention to getting this thing up and running and embedded and part of business as usual for the organization. They can't do it part-time. They can't do it on top of their existing work.
That's right. And I believe that you should have a mix between oracles and young guns here. You need the young guns, the energy, enthusiasm, and a new blood, but you do want to have some oracles there here who have been there before and aren't going to be running around the corridors rushing and say, well, hold it, let's just think about this before we go ahead. So it's a nice mix in that team. That's the term which I've used as oracles and young guns. We also must avoid having any member of the SMT, which I stands, of course, for senior management team, on that team. Very seldom will you get an SMT member saying they want to be on the project team, but if you do, you immediately explain to them why, because the main reason being is they will not be able to move out of their office and become dedicated. They will be caught up in firefighting, and that will mean deferred meetings, deferred things, and the project team can't afford that. But you will find some SMT members who are very interested. Just keep them informed with updates. Pop in at 5 o'clock with a drink and a little PowerPoint with 10 slides and saying, this is where we are, you know, and so forth. That's a way to keep them informed. For heaven's sake, though, don't have them in your workshops or working party meetings, because they'll love the intellectual thought processes, and that's quite soon you'll find that the meetings will go nowhere. It's just nice intellectual talk.
And that sounds like it's going to conflict with what your lesson six is, which is called, you've called it Just Do It. It sounds a bit like action learning to me, David. What's this sixth lesson about?
It's about recognizing that there's no right or wrong. here. What we've got to do is find the performance measures that best fit at the organization and recognize that you're never going to get it 100% right anyway. So what we want to do is get the right team, pick the best team we can, give them the best help we can, fill out any shortfalls in knowledge that they have, which the facilitator will do, and then trust them that they're going to get that right. Now, this is a very important in the sense that the team must be empowered to make a lot of decisions. We do not want the team having to go to the SMT saying, this is how the balanced scorecard's going to look. We are going to have the project team actually designing and building the displays, and the SMT have got to have already endorsed them. So whatever they come up with will be what we're going to run with. And after 6 months of working with it, the SMT will have lots of suggestions, and we will have logged all those, and we will then come back to them and say, this is what you said. And half those suggestions, the SMT will even deny even that they said them when they realize, after a bit of experience, how it works. So that's a very important step. It's the empowerment of the team to make decisions regarding displays and so forth, how the information
is going to work. This thing about displays, David, I mean, that lesson six is nice and punchy. It also alludes to what I think might relate to the seventh lesson about using existing systems for the first 12 months. Is that what you're talking about with the displays, that the team's actually using what they've currently got in place to start building these things?
Yeah, in a 16-week project, there's no way you've got time to start evaluating what balanced scorecard software there is out there.
This is what you meant before about talking about the applications you alluded earlier.
That's
on.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
So we don't look, many organizations through purchasing of software have already acquired some form of balanced scorecard application anyway. So I'm saying, well, fine, use it. If not, you can... You've got lots of other packages, and you can get them if you haven't got those on site. You can get quite a lot freeware anyway. I'm saying do not invest money, because if you are investing money, you're going to have to go up, do an RFI, evaluate it, and so forth. By the time you've done that, you're 2 months down the track, or even 3 months,
yeah.
And I can guarantee you one thing: you'll have bought the wrong package. Because you don't know what you're looking for, so why don't you, you know, get the project started, use what you've got, the systems that you've got. Microsoft have got quite a lot of products, you know, you can use Excel for to do things. There's also some balanced scorecard applications that were provided by Microsoft and other organizations available free of charge. Get hold of those, use it, get experience, and then when you have experience, start looking at a much more bolted down application that's going to fit. But please remember, if you follow the philosophy that I expound in my book, you will find that most applications aren't following it. In other words, they boast that you can have 200 or 300 KPIs. So if you like, exactly, most of the applications are based around the old thinking, and so you're going to have to change them. Yeah, you're going to have to change them anyway. Bear that in mind. And the other thing is,
that's
for example,
a really important thing. I know of. Sorry, David. I know that the delay in the satellite's making it hard for us to flow with this. So I apologise to everybody for this.
Oh, that's right. No,
sounds
problem.
Like we're interrupting each other all the time. One organization I know of years ago had spent $2 million building a dashboard and scorecard system before they had even defined what performance measures were important. They hadn't even defined the critical success factors, and they threw the whole thing out. David, I just think if they'd heard this lesson and really took it on board, they would have obviously saved themselves a gross amount of money.
Indeed. And an interesting story. One of the initial people who are going to publish the book, I won't name them, but they're a very good organisation. But they wanted that step that lesson removed because it didn't suit their their objectives.
Uh-huh.
So So, you know, quite clearly, a lot of application providers would like you to rush into applications. I'm saying don't do that.
Absolutely. So let's move on to lesson eight, David. I'm just conscious that I'd like to allow a little bit of time for callers to get some questions answered, and some of them have started to already come through via the webinar. Lesson eight, trapping performance measures in a database and making them available to all teams. Expand on that one a little bit for us, David.
Yeah, in my book, I set out the various fields that you would need, and people can access that again, that information on the 12-step process, the January paper, which I put on www.bettermanagement.com, so I won't go over it now. But the importance is that you must have a database that's available to all staff. So let's just look at the databases that you've probably got available. You've certainly probably got Access. You've probably got Excel. Now, Excel is a bit of a primitive database. One of the criteria would be that you need multi-users to be able to look at the database at the same time, so you have to think about that issue. But it's a quite simple one. What we're trying to do is make sure in every brainstorming session around the country that's happening at this critical phase of step eight in the 12-step process, measures are being trapped in the database during that session. Nobody's allowed to leave the workshops until all measures are put in the database. Why? Because otherwise they are going to be on flip charts or printouts from the electronic whiteboard, and you know where they end up. They just end up on a shelf gathering dust. So we've got to get those in, because any one of those measures could be that KPI that you know, will be worth millions to you. So we've got to make sure it's trapped. And what happens is, as we start trapping it
consistently as well, I imagine, for the whole organization, there's one way to calculate that measure. There's one, you know, one definition for each performance measure, not seven different definitions and calculations of the cycle time, for example.
Yeah, indeed. And also, you know, with these measures, in different workshops, what will happen is the KPI team will start getting excited as they start coming across the same measure cropping up time and time again. In the airlines story, different teams would have said, well, why don't we measure late planes in the sky? Because that would help us. You know, that way we'd start focusing in on them. And then suddenly people say, well, we've now hit this five times, and we've tested it, and it's got all the characteristics of a KPI, and that's how you discover them, you see. That's and that's why we've got to trap them in the database. So that's the importance of having a database available, which is updated immediately the project starts.
Well, that's tremendous, tremendous advice. Where are we up to? Lesson nine? KPI yes. Reporting formats are an art form, not a science. I guess if I had $10 for every badly and uselessly designed performance report I'd ever seen, I'd probably be sitting on a beach in the Whitsunday Islands and not talking with you right now, David, as enjoyable as that is. I reckon that its report design just hasn't come naturally for many of us. It's got a very profound impact on what we can get out of our performance measures, though. So, David, what can you share with us here about reporting formats?
I mean, in order to sort of produce a decision-based report, the first thing you've got to do is think about what decisions are people going to make from this information. At the end of the day, if no decision's going to be made, you've got to question why you're providing it in the first place, because I'm not into information memorandums. I really don't think nowadays we've got the time for them. So a lot of data can disappear because of that. Now, coming down to the design, I know that you've interviewed Stephen Few, haven't you?
Last year.
Yeah, and I would recommend everybody to track down his work, and maybe Stacey should put a link to his site. Have you, his Perpetual site, I think Perpetual Consulting site or whatever it's called.
Perpetual Edge.
I'll send it to you anyway.
Perceptual Edge, that's it.
That's it.
I actually have links to his books as well. I will relink and remind everybody where to find that information. He's tremendous. He's a lovely fellow, and he's just very knowledgeable.
And he's got some lovely white papers that are free. So I think, you know, starting point, go there and then grab hold of his book. So they're the sorts of people who are also shedding light in this area. And again, I think this is where the facilitator can help. It's very important the project team don't get sidetracked by the typical rocket scientist, because that's where most reports fall down, is when you get the rocket scientist, the person who always wanted to be working for NASA. And so instead of that, they play out their frustrations on any report they design or any Excel they build. And these people are often a nightmare in organizations.
It needs to be about the usability, not the technical features. It has to be about getting useful information and making it as usable and easy to interpret and draw conclusions from as possible, and not about using the latest in traffic light technology.
Indeed.
Excellent. So are we up to lesson 10, David?
Yeah, and that's a very simple one. I've really sort of discussed it. You need to think about it. I believe all companies should have a nice competition. So in step five, when the CEO's going around the organization to explain in the roadshow what we're going to do here, and to those CEOs, I say to you, don't do this by video. You can't. You actually have to do a physical roadshow, be out there, be seen to be talking it, because they've got to believe you here, that you are passionate about it. And there that they would announce, look, we're going to have a competition. We're going to put this form of measure in. It's a sort of balanced scorecard type of approach. Explain what that is, of course. And then say, we want to know what name for it. And they'd have a prize, maybe a week's holiday in some exotic location or whatever it is. But certainly get the organization involved. And, you know, some companies have called it Navigator. Somebody's called it Compass. You know, anything that fits. But I think... yes, we will have a balanced scorecard methodology, but we don't need to call it a balanced scorecard. That the name may not be appropriate. It may not be more negative than positive.
The best example of a name for a performance measurement system that I've ever come across, and I have to proudly say I was there when it was conceived, was Screamin' Success. I think it's brilliant.
Say that again.
Screaming Success.
Okay, yep.
It was a lot of fun, and I think it was meant as a joke, but it stuck. It's been in that organization for many, many years. But this is what you're saying, David, is, you know, think differently about the way we name the system. It doesn't have to be called anything dull and boring and typical or a balanced scorecard or anything. It doesn't have to be called that. You can make it really unique. You can badge it for your own organization and give it a life and a persona of its own, something that's meaningful and hopefully a bit of fun, I guess.
Indeed. Yeah, there's got to be fun in the workplace for sure.
Tremendous. David, I cannot believe, and I have to admit I was getting worried that we would actually get through all 10 lessons in under an hour. Normally I only sort of explore about 5 to 7 points with my guests, but you've been a champion in giving us such practical tips for so many of those lessons in such a short period of time. So thank you very much for that. Now, I'm going to unmute the call in just a bit for those of you who might be on the line and have a question or a comment for David. If you're listening online via the webinar, then now's the time for you to submit your questions via the webpage. And David, while everyone does get their questions ready, perhaps you could talk a little bit more about your book, Key Performance Indicators, because really we've just touched on the philosophy, I guess, or those 10 lessons that underpin a lot of what's in the book. So could you give us a bit of an overview of what people will find in it?
Look, yes, certainly. Firstly, this book came from initially there was a KPI manual which I discovered, which Oz Industries had sponsored, and it was performance management practitioners in industry had got together through Oz Industries and looked at all their performance measurement implementations in industry, and they had come across the balanced scorecard because it was in 1996. That's 4 years after the scorecard. So they took that on board and they looked at what they'd done and they designed the 12-step process and designed the four foundation stones. I talked to Oz Industries about it and said, look, this work needs to be revitalized. It's great. It needs to incorporate the balanced scorecard in a much more thorough way. And also I'd like to incorporate my vision of what performance measures are. And so forth. And so Long story short, they weren't going to be involved any longer, so I took over the intellectual property of the existing work and then brought it all together. And that's where this book is. So I must, and I always do pay tribute to those people who designed this kit. And my book follows very similar to the format. One was about explaining the steps, and another section about the resource kit that each step would need. Obviously, the resource kit's been changed dramatically. But the 12 steps, starting with the senior management commitment, the 12 steps are very much the same as they were. And, you know, why change something which is a great piece of work? So we start off by explaining a little bit about the new thinking, and then that's in chapters 1 and 2. And then we talk about the 12-step process and each step's outlined, and then chapter 4, there's a worksheet for each step along the journey. Step 5, I've put in there a lot of templates for reporting measures, some templates just to help people get started. I'm not saying these are the world's best practice. I'd say just look at these. And a facilitator's, believe it or not, resource kit. You know, the external facilitator we talked about. Haven't forgotten them. They've got there. And at the back, I've got a little bit of a database of measures.
Well, that's tremendous. So it very, and this is exactly what I thought when I'd read it, was just how practical it is. It's, you know, just get in there and get started. And you've just loaded the book with the tools and the templates to help people do that. So, David, we've actually already got a question, at least one question coming through on the webinar, but what I'll do first is just unmute the lines and see if we have any callers on the line that want to ask a question before we go to the webinar questions. So bear with me while I unmute. Lovely. So is there anybody out there on the line with us today who'd like to ask a question for David? No, I think everybody's joined us by webinar today, David. I'll just mute the lines again. And we'll go to, firstly, I've got to say hi to Steve in Auckland. So someone in your country over there, David's joining us live. Steve's just sent through a bit of a hi, so hi back at you. Pete, you're in sunny London, apparently, and this is your question. What's the right level to introduce a performance measurement pilot? And David, when you were talking of dealing with the senior management team, that implies heading straight to the top. Now, Pete knows that KPIs should cascade from the company strategy, but in large organisations, especially government departments, it's nigh on impossible to sell a full restructure of the company's KPIs without a trial run. David, what are your thoughts about that?
There's a couple of questions in there. So this first thing, I've always said the CEO must be involved. Now, I have been questioned about this many times. It is possible that if you had a 2IC to the CEO and they were completely sold on it and the CEO rubber stamps everything that 2IC says, then...
Well, I'm disappointed to say that's where our teleseminar system cut us off due to a technical issue, and we've lost forever the final comments David made in responding to Pete's question. So I've just added this extra bit to reiterate David's response and to formally close the teleseminar. David really emphasised the importance of having the CEO and other executives absolutely behind any performance measurement effort you wish to undertake, whether it's a full-on go or whether it's a pilot. Even if it is a pilot, you at least want the CEO to sanction it, to be aware of it happening, and to be ready to listen to the results and take the learnings on board along with recommendations for rolling out the performance measurement system organisation-wide. David also offered the very sound advice of running not just one pilot, but two, to avoid writing off the whole performance measurement initiative idea just because one or two inevitable problems that can and do happen when we're trying something new. So many, many thanks to David Parmenter for his generous sharing of such practical tips and tactics to help you take on his 10 lessons for implementing KPIs. Thanks also to everyone who joined us on the teleseminar, either by phone or by webinar. The call recording will be available online, and I'll leave it there for you to listen to for 48 hours following the teleseminar. Also via email, I'll tell you how you can get a copy of the teleseminar MP3 recording and the written transcript too, for those of you who like to read and highlight the most pertinent parts for yourself. I'm looking forward to sharing lots more practical performance measure ideas and tips with you in future teleseminars, particularly next month when my guest is Professor Andy Neely from Cranfield School of Management in the UK. He's co-author of a great book called The Performance Prism. Now, as we covered with David in this call today, getting senior executive commitment to performance measurement is really, really important, and we know how challenging that can be. So what I'll be talking with Professor Andy Neely about in March is how to create a compelling case for performance measurement and management in your organisation that can convince senior managers of its importance. In the meantime, please come visit me at www.stacybarr.com, StacyBarr.com. And if you're not a subscriber already, you can sign up there for my twice monthly free email newsletter, Measurement Handy Hints, and check out the next Performance Measure Blueprint workshop coming up in April, where you can learn the step-by-step process for designing and implementing meaningful KPIs and performance measures with loads of buy-in. Thanks for joining the call, everyone. Have a great day and catch you next month.